So when the Buddha went through the profound transformation of the heart that is described in this one climactic night of practice that leads to his full awakening, it's described in the early texts in the form of three insights or knowledges. They're called the tivijja, three knowledges, three things that he knew that night. And this knowing, the texts say, came about as a result of his practice, and particularly as a result of having trained his attention, his mind, to be capable of seeing into reality or things as they are. And this quality of mind that is capable of seeing this deeply is trained by deep meditation, it's trained by concentration, it's trained by focus, it's trained by mindfulness. And the sense of this mind that could see so clearly as to understand reality in one night is that the attention is so precise that it can understand completely whatever it's looking at. It just needs to look at something and you understand, one understands it. And this might seem like a superhuman endeavor, which it kind of is, but it's also not. It's the endeavor of one who has practiced a lot. So I'm a musician by training, as is Eugene. It's one of our connections. And one of the things that music training taught me is that when I listen to music that's in kind of the standard tonal Western format, you know, chords, chord progressions, things being in a key, that sort of thing. Not all music is like that, but lots is. When I hear that music, without even really thinking about it, I understand what's happening structurally. I know when we've gotten back to what we call the one chord. I know when we're on the five chord or the six chord or the flat two, the Neapolitan, like alternate to five. And, you know, there's a grammar to it. In the same way that there's a language probably that you speak as your primary language. You understand it without having to think about it. So when I say this sentence, you probably don't have to go, wait a minute, that was the noun and that was the verb. So that means the action. So then that's doing that. You don't have to do that. You are what's called fluent in some language, probably. I don't know you distinctly, but you probably are. Fluency means you get it without having to think too much about it. Your power of language is well developed, right? So for me, my power in music is pretty well developed. I never became a really great player, but I was a really great listener. And this, to some of my friends who are non-musicians, is kind of a superpower, you know? Somebody's like, oh, I really like that song, you know? And I'm like, oh yeah, it goes like this. And I sit down at the piano and I play it. And they're like, you punk. You heard it once. You don't even like it, but you can just play it. And I'm like, yeah. Liking it doesn't matter. I understand it, right? Likewise, language. Likewise for you, probably, whatever it is, the thing that you're super good at, right? You're a programmer. You look at the thing, you get it, right? You're an expert in this or that thing. You look at it, you get it, okay? The Buddha's goal was to be an expert in reality. He said, I want to know what's up. And particularly, I want to know what's up with death, with birth and loss and death. That was the thing that haunted him. Right? He saw the old person, the sick person, and the corpse, and he was like, dude, that is not okay. He was super sheltered, and the myth makes him hyper sheltered. Like, his dad didn't let him go outside the walls to experience the world at all. So he was traumatized, privileged, rich kid. Right? He doesn't know the world at all. And then he sees a corpse and an old person, and he's like, no, that could happen to me, And his charioteer, who is working class and totally knows about loss and death because he's working class, right? He's not sheltered. The charioteer, Channa is his name, he says, like, yeah, it's totally, that's how it works. The Buddha's totally mind blown. And he devotes his life then to figuring this out. He says, I'm going to reach the deathless, which really means I'm going to understand death. That's the question. That's the heart of practice. You're going to die. WTF. Right? So if you have, if you think that the point of practice is to get a little calmer so that you can deal with our completely, like, fucked up modern world, is not the point of practice. That's a side effect. It's a very good side effect. But the point, actually, is that you get a little calmer so that you can understand the world. And when you understand it, you will be able to see why you're a mess and why you don't have to be a mess around it, even though the world is a mess. The world will not stop being a mess. But you can stop being a mess. So the Buddha makes this his plan. He gets a lot of training. And what he becomes a virtuoso in, or fluent in, is observation. He looks at the world. And he does this by making his mind, the text says, malleable, right? Able to be directed. So when he looks at something, he understands it. The way I understand a piece of music, or you understand the thing that you're fluent at, he looks at reality and understands this. What does he look at? He looks at birth and death, right? Because that was the question. What's up with death? So he does all this super intense meditation training. He gets really, really good at focusing his mind. He finally, like, totally conquers pleasure and pain. He puts himself through really intense practice. And then he figures out that the way to do this, really, is to combine intense focus with intense contact with bodily pleasure, and then to rest in an extraordinarily easeful, bright, non-striving, but very, very focused state. And that's a really interesting balance. It's super intense concentration, but it has bliss in it, right? He has to remember himself as a child, and he's like, oh, I was a child, and I meditated in this way. It's so pleasurable in the body. He said, is that the way? And his intuition goes, oh, that's the way. So he does all this training, and he figures this out, how to make the mind so workable. And then what does he do? This is what I want to talk about. What does he do then? Once he's got his instrument, right? Once he's a musician that can play anything, what does he choose to play? So he sits down, Bodhi tree, nightfall, conquers the armies of Mara. Let's talk about that some other time. Deals with lust, deals with fear, deals with anger, deals with doubt, and finally he's alone. And then here's what the text says, and I'll say it in first person because this is how he says it in the Pali texts. This is his autobiographical account of awakening. He says, and then when my mind was made focused and malleable, able to be directed, I directed it to the knowledge of past lives. He directs it to rebirth. That's where he looks. So, reincarnation, yeah? How many folks in here believe in reincarnation? Good, doesn't matter at all. You don't have to. It's not to be believed in. The point of the text is that it's a thing that you will observe if you look. How many people here believe in atoms and quarks? Why? Have you ever seen one? Yeah? You believe it because you believe the priests who told you about it. Yeah? The scientists. That's priests. Same, same. They're telling you about something that they've observed through their virtuosic practice, through their instruments that have been well-tuned to focus on things. They can read data that you can't. So you believe them. Yeah? Why do you believe them? Yeah, we have a whole culture set up to believe them. That's cool. I think they're right about some things. Yeah? There's these whole other scientists that have trained the mind to be malleable and focusable and able to be directed. And they say that when you look, you will discern a string of past lives. Why don't you believe them? You can't see that either. It's just as fictional as the other thing. Yeah? Or it's just as much a matter of belief. So it doesn't matter if you believe atoms. Gravity still works. You don't have to believe in it. It doesn't matter if you believe in rebirth, right? Cause and effect still works. But the Buddha was a scientist of observation of birth and death. And so this is how he describes it. I saw my past births. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 cosmic eons expanding and contracting. What I saw was, here's where I was born. This was my name. This was my clan. This is what I ate. This is what I did. This is how I died. And this is where I was reborn from there. So I'm going to take this apart a little bit. And the first thing I want to say is, does it help you out if we think of this as a metaphor rather than material? And now I want to propose something else. What if the metaphor is family? What if this means ancestry? At other points in the text, people say, Blessed One, you teach, you know, the absence of the self. But then you say, I. What are you talking about? And he says, oh, when I say I, I'm just saying that because it's conventional grammar. I don't mean there's an existent being here. That's just a conventional way of talking about this thing. So when he says, I directed my mind to the knowledge of past births. Here I was born. That was my name. That was my clan. What does the I and my refer to in this? Because there ain't no self that gets reborn. What's the Buddha talking about? So here's a couple of ways to think about this as metaphor. One, he's talking about family and ancestry and heritage. I was adopted at birth. My birth mom was English. My birth dad was Puerto Rican. I was adopted into a family of German and Italian Catholics, one of whom came from a converted Jewish lineage. So I'm part Jewish, Catholic, Episcopal, Pentecostal on the Puerto Rican side. So my blood roots go through Spain and England, the two great colonial powers. So there's blood, there's a lot of blood there. On the other side, Catholics. Oh, yeah. So, I saw my past births one generation back. My dad was a Puerto Rican guy in the Bronx. He saw his best friend killed in front of him on the street in the Bronx. His family was Pentecostal ministers. They moved back to Puerto Rico. He stayed in New York because his whole life was there. He ended up fleeing New York City to flee the violence, put himself through high school alone, living in the YMCA in Connecticut. Joined the Navy. Had a fling with a nice Episcopal girl from Illinois. She gave the kid up for adoption. Almost had an abortion. Got permission from the state of Massachusetts to have an abortion. Was sitting at a Janis Joplin concert in Harvard Square. The power went out. She sat in the bleachers in the silence, pregnant, alone. Changed her mind. Went back home to Illinois, had the baby. A couple of nice Catholic kids, grad students, adopted a kid they hadn't been able to conceive. Drove him out to California. Here I am. Hometown Bay Area. Well, so one generation back. That's my web. Yeah? So then two generations back, Pentecostal ministers in Puerto Rico, Jewish immigrant in Pennsylvania converting to Catholicism, Italians one generation from Naples, Italy, and Episcopal priests on the Illinois side. I got priests all over. So here I am. One, two, he says three, four, five. Five generations back, we're all Europeans. The colonial era is in full swing. My Spaniards are causing havoc up and down the Western Hemisphere, and my British still have an empire upon whom the sun never sets. I hear it's setting on October 31st. And good riddance, y'all. Thank you very much for destroying the planet in part. This Friday is the climate strike. So me and some other Buddhists will be at the federal building at 10 a.m. Come join us there if you want, or join anybody. Don't go to work. Don't go to school. Fridays for Future is the hashtag if you want to get on the boat with St. Greta and the others. Climate change is one of the results of colonialism. Right? The colonial process was the European powers mining the world for its energy and its resources, mining every culture for its resources. Ten generations back, 100 generations back, I do a meditation sometimes where I say, do you know who your people are? Who your racial people are, who your heritage people are? How far back do you have to go before you get to a land base where your language and your cultures and your people and your food and your stories come from that place? How far back do you have to go before you get to a people who has a word for the people that means the people of this place? You know, or where there's a myth that says we were created here? Yeah, the creation myth I grew up with was, of course, this Tigris-Euphrates thing. I was just listening to the radio talking about the U.S. withdrawing from Syria and the fighting still going on there. And it was saying, you know, how much of a push it's been to liberate the Euphrates Valley. And I'm like, the Euphrates. The Euphrates runs through the Garden of Eden. That's the creation myth of my religion. So part of my proposal here is learn your history, learn your heritage, learn your family's history as a way to do this investigation that the Buddha did. I saw my past lives, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 1,000. Learn history. Here's a second way to think about that. When we think about rebirth or reincarnation, often, and I think when I say we, I'm going to say folks often in non-indigenous convert Buddhist communities, like Insight Meditation, for instance. Often when we talk about rebirth or reincarnation, we might have ideas about it that are from the popular culture, and that may well have been influenced, for instance, by Hindu ideas about it. Because some of the first places these ideas came to the West was through the Bhagavad Gita, which arrived in America around about the 1850s. Emerson, as in Ralph Waldo, the great preacher from Boston, Concord, Massachusetts, preached as a wandering tent preacher for much of his professional life, riding the trains from small town to small town, giving talks. And he was given at one point a copy of one of the first translations of the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of the Divine, where Krishna, in the Hindu tradition, teaches the warrior Arjuna about rebirth, about birth and death, about cause and effect, about the fruit of one's actions and letting go of the fruit of one's actions. And says, you know, when a person, you know, wears out their body like an old suit of clothes, they just take it off and put on a new one. But the idea in that system is that there is a soul that takes off and puts on bodies, that there is a self there. That's not what the Buddha taught. So we might be influenced by that, right, by this preacher who is at the heart of the Unitarian tradition in whose church we now sit. That's not what the Buddha was saying. So our ideas of it get in the way. The scientists, the priests we trust, tell us that the very atoms of our body are inseparable from the atoms of everything around us, that we trade particles with the air around us, that we breathe the same air, poetically, you may say, that I think the first time I heard it was like the same air that Napoleon or Cleopatra breathed. And I'm like, why just them? Why not everybody else? You know, but they're famous, you know, breathe the same air that Cleopatra breathed. When you really think about the atoms of your body, the material of your body being constantly recycled, and then perhaps you think about language and thought and like, where did you get all your ideas? All of that also recycled. You learned it, things from your family, from your culture. All of the stories and the ways I tell my stories, where'd that come from? You know, aspects of myself. Now that I'm a married man and a father, I know what it feels like to be, you know, exhausted and overwhelmed. And I know the way that it feels right to respond to my exhaustion and overwhelm by kind of shutting down and being stoic and being like, I will just bear it and I will move through. And there's nothing to express here. I can just bear the weight of this thing with a kind of quiet endurance. And now I know something that I inherited from my father, who did exactly that. And I remember meeting his father, who was the one that was Jewish and converted. And now I feel like I know something about that side of my line. But what does that mean around the self? Is that me? The stoic, unemotional, standard American male conditioning? Do I own that? Oh, that was just an inheritance. That was part of, you know, that was part of my, what I, that was my early inheritance. He's not dead yet, so, you know. I suppose I'll get a tiny bit of money later on, but I got an emotional inheritance first. Thanks, Dad. Not his fault, right? He couldn't have transmitted anything else. That's how trauma works. So here's some layers. Rebirth means family. Rebirth means bodies interconnected to nature. Rebirth means thoughts connected to your culture. Rebirth means trauma. I particularly want to say that one. Rebirth means trauma. Here's a clinical definition of trauma. Something bad happened a long time ago, and instead of it being processed in your body-mind, your defense mechanisms working to do their thing, and you recovering a sense of safety and letting it go, instead of that happening, which would be the healthy thing, what happened instead is that some part of it got stuck. And so some vigilance, some fear, some panic, some rage, some shutdown stuck in the body-mind because it wasn't able to move through. When was the first time in my life that I felt like the world was completely overwhelming and I didn't know how to deal with it, so I just closed down into myself? I was adopted at birth. And at one point in deep practice, I had an image come. And the image was like red and fleshy, and it was a little bit like one red, wet, fleshy thing being pulled away from another red, wet, fleshy thing with strands of flesh tearing in between them. When I feel into myself for the origin of something that feels so at the heart of my personality, which is the feeling of being an alien on this planet, of not belonging to anyone, of not being connected to anything, And I think about this young woman at the Janis Joplin concert deciding to have the baby, but then, you know, she had about 6 hours with me, I hear. And then I was off with these people of a whole different religion. I was born Episcopal and raised by Catholics, right? If this was 100 years ago, I would say, I was born in the Church of England, but I was raised by papists people, right? They had wars over these things, right? And may yet, in a couple weeks, right? If the Irish backstop doesn't work, it won't, yeah? Part of what I'm trying to propose to you here is that what we think of as history, socio-political history, colonialism and the movement of money and resources, and what we think of as personality and like the self, and what we think of as like the Dharma and sort of universal forces, I want to say all of this is not different things. All of this is a web of the same thing happening. And that thing, the Buddha said, is that everything unfolds in a conditioned, connected way, in an interconnected way. This is what he saw, right? He said, oh, this was my name, this was my clan. He saw class, he saw heritage, he saw ethnicity, right? If I saw my name and my class, when I finally met my birth mom when I was like 23, I was actually living in a Zen center in New Mexico when I got the letter from her that she had finally reached out to find me. And Catholic Social Services in Illinois had done the maneuver to find me, and they found me, and I was living at this Zen center and practicing, and I got this letter, and I was like, whoa, past life. My past life has come to find me. And when I finally met her, she told me that in the one day that I had been her son and not someone else's, whatever that means, she had named me Matthew Eli. Eli was my birth dad's name. So for one day, my name was Matthew Eliezer Pierce from Peoria, Illinois. And exactly one day later, my name became Sean Michael Feit, destined for California. What's my name? Empty. I saw my name, I saw my class, right? If my birth dad had not been a poor brown-skinned guy in the Navy, would they have actually been able to get married and stay together? Maybe. But racism in 1970 was not like that. It would not have been so easy for them to be a biracial couple in Illinois in the 70s. Could have been worse, but it could have been better. Clearly, it wasn't possible for them. He said, I saw my name, my clan, what I ate. I think that's just, again, culture. How I died, where I was reborn. You know. So, a couple proposals here. Do ancestor work. Actually learn who your people are. In a concrete, material way, what's your racial ethnicity? Do your work on whiteness, if you're white. Do your work on your exact immigrant narrative, if you're not, if you are. Wherever you come from, if you're not indigenous, First Peoples, Native American, you're an immigrant here. Where'd you come from? What's your language? What's your people? What's your class? This is, I think, at the heart both of, and I think this is one of the things that bridges social justice work, psychological work, and Buddhist liberation work. So the Buddha sees all his past lives, goes way back, countless eons expanding and contracting. For the second insight, he sees how that's true for everybody. So he basically takes his malleable, focused mind, directs it inward, and then directs it outward, and sees how people pass on in accord with their actions. That's the technical phrase. He sees kamma, or karma in Sanskrit, the more common version we hear. And what he really comes down to when he emerges from this process is he understands that our actions are what determine our future. And as soon as you can see that really clearly, pristinely clearly, let's say you become a scientist, you get really, really good at like microbiology. And let's say you get really good particularly at pathology, let's say diseases. Yeah? Let's say you really know what it's like to look through a microscope at a fluid solution that is, let's say, not toxic. Yeah, some like really clean water. You learn what clean water looks like in a very expert way, not just in a like, oh yeah, it's pretty clean, you know, Hetch Hetchy water is pretty good. Not like that. Really, really precise. And then you get so good at that that you could see, using your instruments and your skill, what it looks like when a microparticle of a toxin, you know, of the polio virus or of mercury or of, you know, glyphosate or something, right? Some gnarly ass industrial thing gets in the water that's going to kill people. You could see that with pristine clarity, right? Would you, if it were at all within your power, let that toxin go into that water? Why would you? It would make no sense, right? It's not random. Someone would hand you a couple vials and they would be like, this is, you know, this is purple food coloring and, you know, and this is Roundup. Put either one into the water you're going to drink. You'd be like, duh, I'll go with purple, you know, or whatever else. Here's the Buddhist proposition. Once you can see pristinely clearly how actions lead to results, how what you do leads to your future birth and to the future of life on this planet, that becomes the third insight, which is the uprooting of the taints, the uprooting of the defilements. Basically, as soon as you see how it works, there's just no way that you would cause harm ever again. Intend harm, that you would do things that are just not wholesome. And it becomes a process, of course, to figure out what that means, how to do that. But you would never again fall into the trap of thinking that it was random or doing things that overtly cause harm based on greed or hatred or delusion. You know, if I was like, oh, I'm attracted to that person and I don't really care about sort of the integrity of relationships, so I'm just going to go for something, right? Like I'm deluded by lust. You would never again do that, because why would you? That would be just like adding a toxin to your clean water. So this is what the Buddha sees. This is why the path is inherently ethical, why the heart of Buddhist practice is ethics, is like take care of your actions. It's kind of the whole thing. And it's why I don't want you to think that you should believe in reincarnation as much as you should trust the scientists that tell you what it means. You know, you don't have to believe in atoms, but I want you to trust the scientists who tell you how germs work. There was a fun movie at one point about the, it was sort of a romance, of course, because they all are nowadays, and it was sort of a kind of historical dramatization, but at the heart of it was there was this doctor. I think actually it was a movie about the invention of the vibrator, to be honest. I remember it's set in the late 19th century in England, my people. And one of the characters is this doctor who works in a hospital for the poor, where the people are dying all the time. And he's this young doctor, and he's gotten there's this new crazy idea going around that there's these invisible things called germs that cause infection. And not everybody believes in it, but he does. He's this young guy. He's reading the new literature. And he goes to this patient who has this like awful, rotting, gangrenous bandage. And he's like, well, let's take off your bandage and clean the wound and put a fresh bandage on. And he's starting to do this. And his elder, superior, the old doctor, comes over and is basically like, why are you wasting good bandage on this? And he said, you people who believe in this new germ theory, that's just quackery. There's no evidence. It's a made up thing. You don't need to do this. And the young doctor is like, you'll see. I can't prove it to you now, but I know it's true. You know, and we should act in this way based on knowing that it's true. We're at this moment where a 16-year-old girl on the autism spectrum is standing in front of the, quote, masters of the universe at Davos, the World Economic Forum, saying, you people caused this climate catastrophe. I've been calling it climate apocalypse. She says, you know, you offer the young people hope. You say, like, what can we do to give the young people hope? She says, I don't want hope. I want you to do something. And she says, I want you to panic. That's what I want. I want you to be afraid and to panic. I want you to act as if your house is on fire, which of course it is. Part of what she's saying is, you know, I want you to wake up to reality, to cause and effect. And if we look at history, we will see, oh, we got here for a reason. We got here because of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the way that people from a few rich cultures thought that they could use the resources of the whole planet in this very particular way. That started off sort of innocently, oh, we burn this stuff and it really helps, you know. And only later it was like, oh, this is really not helping. And in a way, I want you to trust the scientists that say that rebirth and cause and effect are real, in the way that she is saying, trust the scientists that say, this is how we caused climate change and this is what I need you to do about it. Stop emissions now. So I think what the Buddha is pointing to then is that even if we don't have the kind of concentrated mind where we could see, you know, our rebirths for ourselves, countless eons of rebirth, even if we can't do that, we can trust the scientists who can do that and who tell us the results of what they can do. And that result is act as if your every action determines the future. Don't be deluded that your actions somehow might not matter in every moment. And once you see that, attend to everything you do. You know, attend to every tank of gas you buy, every plane flight. Mostly I want to say, stop flying. Just stop, you know, unless you absolutely have to. Right? And it's important to say, individual change won't defeat this thing, right? Elect a better government, because so much needs to change. The reflection on rebirth cuts through everything that we think about who we are and what we're doing. And it proposes that liberation or enlightenment is not personal as much as the end of the personal. No one being gets enlightened except that one being can realize that they have existed forever, which is to say that this one being you think you are is just this moment's consciousness, the leading tip edge of a life of change and interconnectedness that's been going on for the entire unfolding of the universe. Learn your personal history, learn your family history, learn your cultural history, learn the history of everything we can know about this earth. Investigate it deeply and then change how we're living based on that investigation. So, We have some time for questions, reflections here. Any thoughts in this direction? Yes, sir.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm Rudy.
Hey, Rudy.
You say you're relatively newly married and a family man.
Yeah.
So I assume you're heterosexual?
Half.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Of course, it's possible to be bisexual or gay and to be newly married and a family man.
Indeed. Indeed. Seems to have always been possible.
Okay.
Cool. Good to have you. Thank you for asking. Yeah.
My name is Seema.
Hey, Seema. Hi, Gracie. Say goodnight, Gracie.
Not Gracie. Reincarnated, probably.
Who knows?
I have a reflection, which is you mentioned the word overwhelmed somewhere at the beginning of your talk.
Yeah.
And that word kept growing and growing. It was a very interesting talk. I've never heard a Dharma talk like it. But And I understood a fair amount about the family and ethnic history because my family emphasized that as I was growing up. We were Eastern European Jews. And I had two sets of living grandparents in my direct family got out of Europe before the Second World War. And all of that. So I have, and I've been studying that for years, but that was a small part of what you said. I'm overwhelmed. That's my reflection. I am overwhelmed.
Yes.
I'm just overwhelmed.
Yes.
I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. Me too. In a certain way, I think this is partly why the Buddha's encouragement to reflect on, you know, rebirth and interconnectedness and conditions and karma, you know, it came at the peak of it. It's the end of his practice, not the beginning. And it comes at the peak of the instructions. So in a way, you start off with, you know, generosity, keeping the precepts, learning to meditate, etc., getting kind. That takes most of us this whole lifetime. Maybe it's taken us hundreds of lifetimes. But, so we don't just jump to, like, think about your rebirths. I talk about it partly, and it's a little unusual to talk about, we don't teach on this stuff much. I talk about it partly because I think, as a member of one of the cultures that is at fault in the current apocalypse, I don't think we have so much time to waste. And like Ms. Thunberg, I do actually want people to get a little startled and panic a little. You know, the end of that Rilke poem that says you must change your life. Like, we must. So overwhelm is natural. I think it's okay. I think it's okay to not think that we have to do super dramatic things, you know? Like, overwhelm a little bit means there's too much information to process and I shut down. That's not entirely useful from a trauma perspective. And with this material, I think what the teaching points to is that this kind of practice becomes possible once there's a certain skill in the mind to attend to it. And that skill partly is going to be the skill that allows one to see vastness or a huge web of things and not get overwhelmed. And so some of that practice is based in immersing the body in pleasure. Right? Concentration practice is primarily about immersing the body in pleasure. And that's a trauma practice, right? There's a huge amount of trauma healing that must be undergone, individually, family system, cultural system, et cetera, before we can do the thing that the Buddha was doing, which was resting in profound embodied pleasure and ease. You just can't do that if the body's still activated. And the reason I emphasize these things as a metaphor is that there is something that we can do about them that I think doesn't have to be that overwhelming. And to me, it mostly on a day-to-day way, because like, yeah, I'm working on my concentration and my meditation and all those things. Like, you know, I can't do the formal Theravada past lives practice. I know people that can, you know, it's not my specialty, but I respect it. I believe them. You don't have to believe that it's material. You know, you could think of it as a kind of lucid dreaming practice and it would still give insight. But I think that on a day-to-day way, the thing that we can do is notice any time our mind state turns toward believing our own separateness or isolation from the system, from everything that is. Whether that comes out in a one-to-one interaction, you know, where our fear of other people may be present, or ancient patterns of culture that come out as bias or discrimination or whatever, judgment come in for of self or other. Basically, be attentive to the old habits of not thinking of ourselves as part of the ancient web of things. And just ask the question over and over, you know, what if I have been here forever doing this, unfolding through the myriad generations in all the places? What if I have access to that? You know? And I earlier today I met some Armenians. I was chatting, you know, one of my friends, and I remember, you know, a time when we were talking about family and heritage. We just had a little conversation about the Armenian genocide, because I make it my practice to know who people are if they want to share and to ask about stories. And we got on to talking about family and how her mother had dealt with this thing and that thing. And it's almost like I don't even have to take it on. It's just like, I just want to know that. Just get interested. Get interested. When I was about 19, I was peaking in my interest in Tolkien. And I had read The Lord of the Rings 12 times. I had read a bunch of the earlier books and all that ancient stuff. And I was so into it. I found myself memorizing the names of the Numenorean kings, the ancient kings of Middle-earth in Tolkien's mythology, because I thought it was just so interesting and beautiful. And halfway through trying to memorize that list, I realized that if I was so interested in memorizing a line of mythical kings, that it might be more useful to memorize a line of real kings. And so then I put that down immediately. I never read them again. And I started studying British history, and I memorized the names of some British kings. And as soon as I did that, it was not hardly as fun, because immediately I could feel the pain in that lineage. I was like, oh, but these kings went to real war, and they did real, like they were attacked, and they attacked, and they were invaded, and they invaded. And suddenly, it wasn't a really fun story about hobbits and orcs and wizards and elves. It was a story about the French and the Swedes and the Italians and the North Africans and the Palestinians and the Indians. And again, I was like, oh, well, that's painful. And in a certain way, history is overwhelming. But there's no escape. You know, you come from Eastern European Jews. Would you be better off not knowing? No, right? So I think that it's like that about everything. The thing that enabled you to know that and not get overwhelmed was connection, was family and community. That's a community that holds its history really well. You know, don't forget, right? That never forget. That, in a certain way, is part of what I think the Buddha was doing. never forget. Know where I came from. This is my name, my clan, what I ate. You know? On my grandfather's side that was Jewish, right? I was Fite. And, you know, we ate Hamantaschen. Like, you know, that was my name, my clan. Like, that's what that practice is. And so learn it is the instruction. Yeah. Yeah. So. That's our time. So I want to thank everyone for being here. And it's such a pleasure to come and chat with you and to open up this can of worms together. It's all of our worms, so we might as well open them. They were already open. I want to wish everyone a beautiful, beautiful fall. And come and find me anytime. And blessings in your practice, always. So thank you so much for being here.